Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest for the 90 minutes to talk with you about what's going on in the world of insects. Join in with a question at 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Phil, welcome back. Great to have you with us. I tell you what, we have an email. I'm going to start with an email with Carl, who has a yellow jacket problem in their yard. It's escalated to the point where they're walking through the low-cut grass. Yard produces an eerie, mesmerizing effect on the ground of crawl. He thinks there's over 1,000 yellow jackets on his property. Our neighbor has since also gotten some yellow jackets from his lawn and wants to get them moved away. He has looked carefully for a ground nest entrance of some sort. He's in the early morning and then evening when they're not active, he's turned everything over and raked and can't find the issue. Tried baiting unsuccessfully with tuna, jelly, soda, commercial yellow jacket bait. He wants to rid the lawn of that.
Well, the thing is that it's an interesting year because overall I would say the yellow jackets are down dramatically. I mean, I'm not getting near the kind of complaints I do with people that are eating outdoors and having trouble. In this scenario, a colony can easily have 2,000 individuals, but they're all going into the same hole. And one would think when you're out in the lawn, if there was a nest in that part of the lawn, you would see the activity. You know, it would catch your attention. You could identify it. So then if that can't be found, what makes me suspicious is there is not a true nest there. They're there foraging, looking for food. And what we commonly get, if you have scales or aphids in your conifer trees or your broadleaf trees, when aphids feed, they secrete this honeydew, and you get this sticky-like substance. Mm-hmm. Be honest, I mean, when somebody calls me up and says, there's a bunch of yellow jackets buzzing around my spruce tree, but I don't see any nests, that's usually what's going on, is they're feeding on the sugar water that's there. It's there every day. It's getting refreshed. So that's the direction I would look here, is that you can't find a nest. Well, then what's the food source? In particular, what I would look to see if there's any sign of any kind of tacky honeydew-like debris on the grass itself or on the plants. The good news about the whole story is we're within a couple weeks of things really shutting down. I mean, it's usually wait until the 1st of November before I know we're totally out of the season, but yellow jackets are in major decline now. You know, they're not getting their food reserves, and so it will subside by itself if nothing's done. But as I said, with what he's telling us, I would look to see there's got to be something that's drawing them there. It's got to be food, and I think it's something natural, and that would probably be the honeydew.
All right, let's turn to Kathy in Ashland, who also has a yellow jacket question, I believe. Hi,
well,
Kathy.
I'm just not sure now that you're talking about yellow jackets. I just assumed I had hornets. Here's what happened at my house. I have a window in the garage, and out of the windowsill, a little mortar fell, which I have replaced, when I don't know, because I'm asking you when I should do that. But the hornets have just been going in there constantly, and I'm wondering, what I could do about it, because we have sprayed with the stuff you buy at the store, and they just keep on going in there. It's
mm-hmm. Sure. Well, a couple thoughts. Interesting enough, the term yellow jacket, hornet, and wasp are somewhat interchangeable for certain creatures. Let's not worry too much about. I assume what you have is a paper wasp that has found some kind of void space in that wall, and they've set up their nest. What I generally use as a rule, if I can't see the nest, I just see where they're going, aerosol sprays don't seem to work very well. For anything that goes in the ground, goes in the wall, goes into some kind of structure, I prefer to use a dust. And there are various dusts that are out there. The problem is how you apply it, because usually these dusts come in what I would consider a giant salt shaker. So it's okay to shake it on the ground, but when you've got something that's going in a vertical wall,
harder.
Yeah, so either you get something that's called a bulb duster that you can get at the hardware store, or you sacrifice an old turkey baster or an old squeezed mustard bottle so you can blow the dust in that entrance. Again, one of the things to consider is we're within a couple, 3 weeks of them just dying out naturally. And after the point that you're sure they're not active, anytime between now and next July, you can plug that hole so that the small chance that, a queen next year tries to find a nest that she doesn't find the same environment. They don't go back to the nest per se, but sometimes if you have an old gopher burrow, they seem to show up there every year just because it's a good place to move into. So again, general rule, use a garden dust, seven garden dust, permethrin dust, deltamethrin dust, pyrethrum dust. They all should really do a pretty good job. And that's, it seems to give us much better effect than the aerosol sprays, which generally that's like the complaint I get. They just don't work.
They don't work.
Unless you can see the nest. If it's just sitting out in front of you and you can soak the nest, then they're perfect.
Good luck. Thanks a lot.
When is it okay to remortar that place?
After the frost.
Yeah. So I'd say the 1st of November till any time into July, you'd be okay.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. And just if you wait. You don't have to put any of that dust, or as Phil says.
You know, we're late enough now, Larry. I would think if things haven't caused so much problem that you had to take care of it, it's probably just let it run its course. If this was the 1st of August, I'd say, boy, we got another, you know,
8-10
weeks of problems.
Mitch in Stoughton, on to you now. Hi, Mitch.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have an old table, probably pine, full of powder post beetles on the legs, and I've seen, for example, like a boric acid or a borax treatment, do it yourself. But do you have any recommendations? Should I just wait and let freezing kill it?
Well, freezing, if you're not careful, won't kill it.
Okay.
You know, because powder post beetles spend the winter in old oak logs and the like. And so if they have a chance to acclimate, you know, so you put it out in the garage and you wait until it gets good and cold, they will be prepared for it. What does kill them, and, you know, I don't know if these legs are removable. If that was the case, I'd say remove them and throw them in your freezer for a couple nights. That would be a way of freezing because you get this quick shock and you're sure you've got 0 degrees. That's the other thing I find people misread is that they think 20 degrees is what is below freezing, but that's not cold enough to get after insects. I mean, I want as cold as I possibly can get. The other option is to go the other direction, to be honest. If there's any way you can heat the wood, a sustained temperature, you know, you don't have to go to a full kiln type of situation, but if you can heat the wood warm enough, it will kill them off.
How much is warm enough?
Well, the critical temperature to the insects, 112 degrees.
No.
But the question is in the internal part of the wood, are you generating that much heat?
No.
And so that's a problem. And again, I think logistically, the size of the table is just not going to work. But it's interesting that, you know, this whole heat technology is picking up. I even saw an item the other day for bedbug control. It's basically a suitcase heater. If you travel a lot, you bring your suitcase home, you drop it in the heater, you close it up, it cooks them out, and an hour or two later, you take it out. So they said we're starting to see more of these kind of devices become available just because they both work, and they're not a traditional pesticide that has some of those issues. But if the cold won't work, the hot won't work, then the borate treatments are powdered-based or liquid-based, but for what you're going to go after, there's a product called Timbor, T-I-M-B-O-R. You can buy it in small quantities, which is the advantage. Mm-hmm. You mix it up with water. You either put it out with a paintbrush or some similar device, let it soak in, and it will basically insect-proof. What boric acid is a stomach poison, so when little critters come into the surface, they feed on it and ingest it, and that's what will kill them.
All right.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for calling. Joanne emailed us and said, about a year and a half ago, I called your show to get advice for my parents who were having a problem with grasshoppers eating the finish off their metal screen door. We live in rural Wood County. You recommended something to spray on the door. We've installed a new door for my parents, but have lost the information on what to spray on the door to keep the grasshoppers off. You know, it may not have been you, Phil. It might have been somebody else who recommended a spray.
Well, a couple thoughts here. And grasshoppers do some real silly things. I have them feeding on plastic screening at times, and I have gotten complaints of them eating the paint off siding. But it's not uniform. And so what you speculate is that there's something in particular paints that they find tasty.
Oh.
And so I'm hoping by purely replacing the door, having a different kind of finish on it, that will be the solution in its own. The problem with spraying is that, you know, most of the sprays that we use for ants and whatnot indoors, sprayed on the door will give you a few days of relief, but they're not long-term at all. So to me, again, it makes more sense to try to find some kind of paint surface or the like that they will not like. And as I said, I'm hoping that by going to a different door, a different kind of paint on it, that they're not showing an interest in it.
Let's go to Sarah in Price County. Hi, Sarah. Thanks for calling.
How are you?
Great.
I have a Luna moth that has, no, not a Luna moth, a Luna caterpillar that has wrapped himself in a hickory leaf and sealed it up in silk.
Mm-hmm.
He did this 14 days ago. Can you tell me how long it will be before he turns into a moth and gets sent outside since it's getting cold?
What I'm assuming is that it will not emerge until next spring. Because, you know, insects, kind of like plants, use the shorter day length to tell them it's getting to be winter, and it would be foolish for the Luna moth to come out now, because any eggs that are laid, they spend the winter as cocoons. I mean, that's the normal. And so any eggs that would be laid, the trees have already dropped leaves. There's nothing for the caterpillars to eat. But in order to get it to develop, it needs a cold shock. And so the way we typically do this is to put it out in the garage or a porch, someplace that's, you know, somewhat protected, but let it go through the normal winter chilling, the normal spring warm-up, and then it will emerge at the normal time, which would be May or June, I would suspect. If you tease it out early, and there are some ways of potentially doing it, but...
you're going to kill it.
it's not going to have a chance.
We don't want to do that.
Yeah, and as I said, I'm guessing that it won't. And if you leave it indoors, you're trying to do it a favor, without the cold shock, it probably won't develop properly anyway.
Okay, so move it to the porch and bring it back for spring.
Yes. Yep. Yes.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks, Sarah. Thank you for calling. And on to Todd in Madison. Todd, hi.
Hello. I have a question. I've been out fishing this year along the streams around here, and I've noticed two things. First off, this year, the hex hatch just didn't happen. We saw five or six, but not the big, massive hatches that we've had in years past. Specifically on Black Earth Creek, it was way down, but also friends up in the McCann said the hatch was way off. And I have seen very few butterflies this year. I was wondering if it was anything or just a...
Yeah, the butterfly thing is probably as poor a butterfly year as I remember. And it was weird because in May I was seeing the swallowtails and stuff, and, you know, that was neat. But, boy, it has just dropped off. And I'm sure that's weather-dependent. Sometimes when you get wet periods at the wrong time, especially when critters are in the caterpillar stage, there's a lot of natural diseases. Plus the cold weather probably slowed some things down. So I agree, and not a good butterfly year. The hex hatch... You know, that one can really vary. It's hard to say, but I'm sure there are, again, environmental conditions within the stream, and things just didn't go right. And overall, it has been, relatively speaking, a light year for insects. I always tease. I was doing a Master Gardener last night up in Ozaukee County. And, you know, in bad years, I honestly am praying for a frost by the 15th of August, just because it's time to slow down. This year, I have not gotten to that point, and of course, now we're to the point that we wouldn't expect it. So it's been an interesting year to watch. I'm going to be very interesting to see what the trap counts look for gypsy moth, to see if their populations were also declined because of the weather. I'm sure hopeful, because last year it wasn't that way. We'll see. But the one thing with insects, with their dynamic reproductive potential, all it takes is things, you know, one year, and it can be just 100% turnaround.
That's what I was going to ask. So this isn't going to have a long-term effect on, like, the hex or butterfly population?
Hopefully not.
No. They always have, because they lay so many eggs, they always have this great reproductive potential. They just need things to be tweaked a little bit, and all of a sudden things are in their favor.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Wanted to mention that we've already taken a day off our fall pledge drive, because for every 700 donations ahead of the drive, we're taking one day off. And you can help make it, too, by making your donation today. And I just looked online, and we have 1,044. We just need 356 more pledges, apparently, somewhere around that number, to cut another day off the drive. Boy, I tell you what, that would be great. Go to WPR.org to donate now and take let's get 2 days off. And if you have a question for Phil Pelletieri, you can join us as well at 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to David in Viroqua. David, hello.
Hi. I was just calling. Earlier you talked about different ways to get rid of yellow jackets that might be in masonry. Mm-hmm. Growing up, my father, we had this same problem. And instead of trying chemicals, he actually just put a wet and dry vac up against the hole, turned it on, and the suction actually held it to the cement and let it run for about a half hour, and we didn't have a bee problem after that.
Yeah, I have corresponded. In fact, it started on the show, I think last time was on with a person by email who has come up with a kind of a similar system that they put the shop vac there. They'll run it for about 3 or 4 minutes and then just shut it down for an hour or two and then run it again, and has had some pretty good success with it. My question to him was, how did the yellow jackets do inside the reservoir? Because I'd be feared that they might be alive and a little bit agitated because of what happened. But he said that they really died quite quickly, which if there was enough dust and other debris, that has some toxic effects on insects and a drying effect, and it works. So it is an option in some cases. In particular, where it gets a little touchy, though, is turning the vac on and off if there are agitated yellow jackets around. But there are definitely some circumstances that this would be an option or alternative for folks.
Yeah.
I was about 7, and it just really made an impact on me, especially when you put it in the garage and said, don't open it for a week.
Yeah, well, you can kind of tell. If the thing is buzzing when it's shut off, you know they're still there. But as I said, the comment the gentleman had made was he found that, indeed, he didn't have any problem with that at all, and you know didn't have to mess with putting pesticides in the reservoir, which would not be something I'd want to do anyway. But
yeah.
Well, thank you. I just wanted to share that.
Yeah, thanks, David. Appreciate the call and the suggestion. And more callers online, so let's go to Jeff in Madison next. Jeff, hello.
Yes, thank you very much.
Sure.
I called in several years ago when Professor Pelletieri was there to talk to him about our termite problem, which we got rid of. Well, now, in the past few months, we've noticed this is on the first floor in the back of the house. In our bathroom, we saw some, what looked like our winged carpenter ants, I believe, coming out from between the baseboard molding and the tile. We shop vacked them up for about a week or so as well. It seems to be a common ruse. But I took the baseboard molding off about last Saturday, and we have seen none since. I didn't put any poison, anything down there. Now, obviously, they're somewhere. But I'm wondering, is there anything we should do, given that it's almost October, and what do you recommend?
Well, the good news about carpenter ants, and I've come to the conclusion we really blew it by calling them carpenter ants, because the vision in most people's mind is they are the equivalent of termites. And biologically, they're very different, because,
right,
you know, termites eat your house, carpenter ants just live there, and they're taking advantage of often softened wood, but they get into other things. And so it's a little bit odd to swarm in this period of time. The typical swarming period for carpenter ants is May and June, but all that suggests is they're in the house and they're all mixed up. And here it pays to be patient and be a detective, because you've got a rough idea, but we're not quite sure exactly where. They definitely weren't behind the baseboard, but they're in that wall space somewhere. They could be taking advantage of a void. They could be taking advantage of some softening wood up above them in the roof. That's hard to say, but the more time you can spend to just kind of pinpoint, and sometimes you just have to sit back and let the ants play their cards. And what's going to happen, I'm suspecting, is that in a couple, 3 weeks, just because temperatures cool down, they're going to stop no matter what.
Right, right.
What will be very interesting is next spring when you see your first ant. And if you see it in March, that suggests an outside wall. If you see it in January, I would argue the walls are too cold. These stinkers are nesting more in an interior, warmer portion of the house.
No, interesting.
So that gives you just a little bit more to go on.
Yeah.
You know, watch it from the outside. When the ants become more active in late April, early May, it would be a good time to put out some honey on a plate in that room and just let the ants find it and see if they show you a little bit more of a pattern. So as I said, you just kind of tweak with things. Don't worry about, you know, any new damage or destruction going on with the ants being there. But you definitely know you got a carpenter ant nest someplace close by, and
yeah,
you might get lucky. You know, I get calls the other way sometimes of people call and say, I got these dead ants all over. I've never sprayed. What's going on? And we do see disease problems going on in some of these colonies, and they just die out naturally. So, but definitely the evidence is they're nesting in that wall somewhere, and now we just have to fine-tune or pinpoint where that is.
Right. It wouldn't help us to spray with a you know, one of these carpenter ant sprays down into that space, would it? I assume they would just ignore that area and go elsewhere.
Well, but if that was the space, if you
was.
Had them surrounded, then you would do them in.
Yeah.
So sometimes, you know, if you have an educated guess, I think it's well worth giving it. If you don't know where they are, I tell people to shoot in the dark. Why bother? Because
right,
the spray does mask things. They do avoid those areas. But if you get the spray to where they are, it will And again, what we're after is killing the queen. That's the whole secret to getting them or not.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. I have a Milton listener who wonders what are the 1 to 1.5 inch black hard-bodied worms that are invading his garage.
Okay. This time of the year, it's millipedes. In the way you would verify they're millipedes, aside from them being crunchy when you walk on them, is if you look very closely, they have 2 pairs of legs for every one of their body segments. So they're little segmented things. And the story with millipedes is they live in the soil, feed on organic matter, and it's quite common in the fall they go through this kind of migration at night. When the sun comes up, they congregate where it's cool, damp, and dark, which is often the cement slab in a garage or a basement.
Sure.
And the mistake people make is they spray that because that's where the critters are. And I always tell them, first of all, I mean, cement is not a good substrate to spray. And that's not the source. The source is outside. And, you know, this late, again, you kind of argue, well, it's probably not worth doing much other than sweeping up what's there. But if you head to treat, what you do is you try to identify where is all the organic matter that they're coming from. It's not your lawn, but it's areas like prairie grass and CRP fields and even some no-till cornfields. There's enough debris rotting there that that's where they are. And if you're going to spray or treat at all, I like to treat as close to that source. So you're basically catching them before they get a chance to migrate in and not so much spraying around the outside foundation of the house or the garage because, they said, then they already got to you. Now, the good news is they're harmless. But, boy, the sheer numbers can be really quite a nuisance. I mean, I have people tell me that they can fill, you know, 4 or 5 shovelfuls or a 5-gallon bucket half full in a day or two, and they're not exaggerating. Wow. You can get that kind of densities in some cases.
Let's turn to John in Stockton, Illinois next. Hi, John.
I have a hard time believing no one's brought this up in the past, but I'll bring it up. I'm going to call it the parable of Rat Island, where scientists are trying to get rid of a bunch of rats in an island, I think it was the Pacific, poisoned them, but the after effects were they killed a bunch of hawks and eagles that fed on the rats. I always worry that when we recommend poisoning insects, there might be an impact on birds or other creatures that might eat the insects. So I was just wondering if maybe you could caution people when they do that there is a possibility that, you know, other animals could be killed when you're poisoning the insects.
It is, although it depends on the poison. Things like strychnine are notorious for those kind of problems. Even some of the blood thinners they use on rodents, the same type of thing. Generally speaking, though, insects don't have high enough concentrations in the way these products work that we get this secondary poisoning effect. Now, it's not that it can't happen, but it really is quite unusual compared to, again, the problems that we've had with rodent control in particular in some of the environmental side effects.
All right. Thanks for calling, John. Appreciate it. Mark in Rock Falls. We're on to you now. Hi, Mark.
How you doing?
Good.
I have a question. It's about, I just wanted to ask you if you noticed any, lately I've been noticing bees that look different than other bees. Like, I don't know if they're crossbreeding into other species or something, but, you know, I just was wondering if you've heard or seen any of this stuff.
Well, the thing I find with bees is most people are not aware of the sheer diversity and large numbers of species we get. You think of bumblebees, you think of honeybees, but we have literally dozens and dozens of solitary bees. And the same with wasps, they're, and so the whole groups are far more diverse. And so you may be seeing a different species than you're used to seeing. The only thing that I have seen move into the state in the recent 2 or 3 years is the European, paper wasp, the Polistes, dominulus has moved in. And, this thing is, the paper wasps that make these nice little nests that you can see the combs underneath, those are the Polistes wasps. And in our native species, it's got a little bit more of a reddish tone to it, but the European species is pure black and yellow. And they often will nest in some pretty crazy places so that you're not even aware the nests are. I had one underneath my one of my windowsills, and I was really quite surprised because they were going up underneath the shutter and the like. And so I said, we do have a couple new things, but my first take when somebody would ask me this, if it's a new bee, I said, boy, if I could see a picture, I could give you an idea. But to realize that there is a lot more bee species out there than most people understand.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question for our guest Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist. Richard in Duluth, we're on to you now. Hi, Richard.
Well, thank you.
Sure.
I want to share something that worked with me for getting rid of yellow jackets. It was told to me by an older gentleman I worked with. I had yellow jackets in my woodshed. I couldn't even go near it, my cabin. And he told me, take a bucket half full of water and hang a dead fish over the center of it. And I tried it. The next day I had a bucket full of dead yellow jackets.
Yeah, that's a trap that has worked, especially for the western yellow jacket species. And what happens is that the yellow jackets, when they cut some of the meat off, they're such little pigs that they have so much weight to it. They just drop down into the soapy water. It doesn't work as well for all species. When the European German yellow jacket moved in, we find it has such a liking for so many different kinds of baits. It doesn't work as well, but it's definitely worth a try.
It solved my problem.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Thanks, Richard.
Okay, you're welcome.
Appreciate it very much. And let's try Bill in Vilas County now. Bill, hello.
Hello. I was resetting an outdoor electrical outlet that has a ground fault circuit interrupter with it. I went out to reset it, and when I pushed on the button, a number of black insects flew up. One of them bit me on the wrist, and boy, it was left a big welt. Really painful. I assume it was a form of wasp, but one of them, I jumped back into the sunroom, and one of them followed me in, and we were able to kill it. It's only 3/8 of an inch long, black, and I wondered what they might be and what I could do about them. I think they're inside that outlet box where the ground fault interrupter is, that they somehow apparently have tripped that circuit.
Well, I'm guessing that there's a nest in there. I mean, it's definitely a paper wasp of some sort or another, and without seeing it, you know, if I could see it, I could tell you which species. But the whole thing is about wasps that live in colonies, live in groups. If their nest is threatened, they're very defensive. What we call solitary wasps that live by themselves don't have a true nest, and you wouldn't get multiple in the same area, plus they're not aggressive at all. So you're right, somebody is nesting up in there, but it's somewhat the same story as the ground nesting yellow jackets, is that we're within a couple, 3 weeks of them going around way naturally. So if you can wait before doing it, that would be one option. The other option, anytime we deal with things in voids, I had mentioned about a dust, and a dust also is a better product to use. You wouldn't want to use a liquid around any kind of electrical outlet, but if you dust very carefully around the entrance, so when they come and go, they get into the dust, it'll do them in very short order.
Okay. Okay, well, I think I'm just going to wait, because this is a vacation and we're not going to be here that much longer anyway. So
yeah.
the winter time should take care of them.
Yeah, definitely. In fact, sure. Really what happens is they starve to death. It's not so much the cold, but there's nothing to eat. They can't get out there. And so I usually use the cutoff date of the 1st of November that any ground nesting or aerial nesting wasps are done.
Okay.
And then you can, you know, check the void and try and figure out where that little hole was.
Thanks very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Joan in Iola, your turn. Hi, Joan.
Good morning.
Morning.
I've got several little pointers. On the box elder bug that lands on the side of our house in the fall now, I have a water vacuum cleaner that I use inside of my home, and I just go outside with that, and I put a little bit of oregano oil in it, and it takes care of them. It also takes care of wasps or hornets, where they might be in a nest also underneath our overhang on our house. But now another one, the squash bug, and it overwinters in the garden. What can I do to decrease its population or get ready for it next spring, the same way with a cucumber beetle?
Yeah,
it'll be a little easier with a squash bug, because if you take something like old shingles and the like and put it in the garden, they will tend to draw into that spot to spend the winter, and then you can just lift them up and physically destroy them. So it's almost like a trap, per se. The problem with cucumber beetles is they're not going to be so enamored with that. They're going to fly off somewhere else, spend the winter as adults, and be back there in the spring. So I really don't have as good a solution for cucumber beetles.
Okay, and then my last one is, I had a caterpillar on my plum tree when I was getting all the plums off, and the caterpillar was fat, It had light yellow hair. It wasn't real hairy, but it had maybe 6 to 8 long black. It looked like maybe they were feelers.
Yeah, but there's really, we call them pencil hairs. That's a form of dagger moth.
How do you spell that, please?
D-A-G-G-E-R.
A dagger moth.
Right.
And what damage does it do?
Minimal. You know, they're quite common on various, and there's more than one species of dagger moth, but as a group, they feed on various broadleaf trees, but never enough numbers to be of a concern.
Well, very good, because I have it. It's now in, I guess it's in its pupae, the brown thing,
mm-hmm.
because I took it off with a bunch of leaves, and it ate all the leaves, because we could see all the droppings from the little... the caterpillar, mm-hmm. but now it's in its cocoon. So what can I do to keep that over the winter, or shouldn't I?
Well, no, that wouldn't be a problem. But again, what's typical of these late summer and early fall caterpillars is they probably are going to need a cold shock to do their thing. And so the best thing to put it in some kind of container that you can keep track of, leave it in an unheated area, and then next spring when it warms up, the moth will emerge. You know, this one could emerge as early as the early part of May.
What about the black and orange caterpillar, the real fuzzy one?
Oh, the banded woolly bear. The thing about that one, which, again, you have to understand their biology, is they don't spin their cocoons down until the spring, and they also need a cold shock. So if you bring them into the house, you know, when they're starting to try to hibernate, they will not survive.
I won't bring them in the house.
So you leave them out in again, unheated area, and then next spring when it starts to warm up, they will spin their cocoons down, and then the adult moths usually emerge sometime in June, is a typical for the woolly bear.
That's B-E-A-R?
Right.
Yep.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And I just went online and typed in dagger moth, and there's a great picture of dagger moths right there to look at.
Yeah, they're a neat group. Now, I for people that are into caterpillars, I think we've talked about on the show before, there is a book that came out with part of the Princeton Field Guide series. It's Caterpillars of Eastern North America that is absolutely exquisite. I don't know officially how many hundreds of different species they have pictured with. Very good pictures of the caterpillar, and then they have a small picture of the adult moth it's going to grow up to be, and then a little bit on life history and stuff. And so, you know, until that book came out, to be honest, there was never any field guide that had enough stuff in there to be of much value. But I find that thing to be extremely useful when I get these kind of calls. And dagger moths, again, the characteristic are those long pencil-like hairs that people sometimes think are antennae.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. Deborah in Winnebago County, we're on to you now. Hi, Deb.
Hi, thank you very much. I always learn a lot when I listen to your programs, Larry. Thank you. I have a bee question also. We have done some excavating and landscaping around our house, and there's some areas that are not seeded. So it's basically just sand that's been just leveled out. And there were some bees, not swarming, but flying around there. They looked like a honeybee, only a little bit bigger, and they were more of a grayish color. I won't say black and white, but they did have some lighter colored stripes, and they were kind of a darkish gray. And my question about their behavior is, they would land on the sand, and it had kind of crusted over a little bit because it had rained and then dried out, and they would burrow into the sand, and you could see them pushing the dirt out with their feet, legs or whatever.
Yeah.
And what were they doing?
Those are solitary bees, and I don't know if they're leafcutter bees. There's really about four families of solitary bees. And bees collect pollen, and what these solitary bees do is dig a burrow, and then they put a collection of that pollen they have collected in there. They lay their egg, and then they're done with it. And so, again, it's not a nest. So they were just excavating these little burrows that they mm-hmm. would utilize. And those kind of bees are usually very seasonal. You know, you'll see them for 2 or 3 weeks, and then they're gone. So it's not something that's out there all summer like the honeybees and bumblebees. And again, there's no true nest, and so they're very non-aggressive. In fact, there are some species that can't sting, but some definitely can. But I always tell people, you have to capture one and bother it to get stung. They're not going to bother you. But when you have the right habitat, in this case, the bare soil, especially loose soil like sand, you can have a number of them working the same area. And so it gives you the impression that there is, quote, a nest, but you have a lot of individual burrows that they're working in. And I'm guessing when you get things seeded over and you get vegetation growing, they won't be there.
Okay, I wasn't worried about them or afraid of them, just the curiosity. And so there would possibly be eggs in there now at this time of year?
Well, there'll probably be grubs. The eggs have hatched. Those grubs have fed on the pollen that their mothers have provided for them. And they may even be in the transformation stage, the pupal stage. They'll get through the winter that way. And
this
then
is last week.
Right. But okay. Yeah, same thing. You know, we're at that point that the insects know it's coming, and so they're preparing for the life stage that is best to get through the winter. And they're either relatively full grown larvae or pupae would be my guess right now.
Very good. Thanks very much for the information.
You bet. Thanks a lot for calling, Deb. Rick in Cambridge, on to you. Hi, Rick.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Great. Thanks for calling.
I have two questions. The basic one is, the first one is about what we call bumblebees, those very large, like black and yellow bees, real plump. They're much, much bigger than normal bees. Do they ground nest?
Yes.
The basic question.
Yes. They commonly use old rodent burrows and washed out areas and stuff.
Okay. Will that be a permanent site?
No. Just like the yellow jackets and hornets start from scratch each spring with a single queen. A colony in this case can get up to 100 or more bumblebees in the heat of summer, and then they start to decline. In the fall, they produce new queens that become fertilized. They crawl under a rock somewhere to spend the winter, and then in the spring, they have to search out a new cavity. So they have no allegiance to the old nest, per se.
Okay, that's good to know.
All right.
The other question was, a number of years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, something like that, I contacted the bee lady who's listed in the Yellow Pages, and we had a large, very, very large swarm of bees on a building. And the short of it was that it was several colonies of honeybees that were kicked out through some farmer's excavation or something, and they were looking for a new hive. And she came and she removed them, found two queens. There were like 50,000 bees, and she took them all away. It was real nice. This year, I noticed a couple weeks ago a large number of bees going back in the same building. I said, "Ooh, I wonder if we have another yellow jacket nest. Another honeybee nest." And I called a friend who raises bees, and he said he'd come down and check it out, and he might take the hive and do what he does with them. We popped the door open, and in the same location where the honeybees were before, there's now a large paper nest against the wall, and he says, no, those are yellow jackets. So my idea at the moment is I'm just going to leave till late November, early December. And as you say, they're probably starved to death. The freezing probably won't take them so much as the cold. My question is, will they come back there again next year because of what they've done in the hive? And how could I?
No.
I would think I would just remove the hive. And how would I, prepare that area so they might not come back? Because they seem to be attracted to exactly the same spot.
Well, it's interesting. I was talking to some DNR wildlife people on Monday, and we were talking about bees and spiders and a few other things. And I showed them a picture of a honeybee colony and a paper wasp nest right next to each other in the same part of the wall void. And it's an environment that could attract both of them. But the thing about yellow jackets is they do not reuse, do not come back, and so there's no need to destroy. It's fine to destroy. As far as preventing this, there must be some kind of crack or opening that the bees are utilizing to come and go, and that needs to be caulked or sealed or tightened in a form. Now, with honeybees, what makes life more complicated is that if the bees are taken out or they're killed, you do need to remove the comb and the honey, both because the honey can ferment, but more importantly, that if it's left behind, if there are other swarms in the neighborhood, they're often attracted to those areas, so you literally draw them in. So I always tell people that do have honeybee colonies in, you've got a double issue to deal with the bees and have them dealt with, but also you need a carpenter or a handy person to open things up, get them cleaned out, or you're going to be back in that problem down the road.
Okay, that was exactly my thinking as well. Okay, thanks a lot for the information. I do appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking insects with Phil Pelletieri. And Phil, we have an email in from someone in Juneau County who says, can I cut the milkweed plants off now, or do the butterflies overwinter on the weed?
Monarchs don't. Monarchs do the migration down to Mexico and head back. I'm trying to think the milkweed tussock moth from what I've never seen the cocoons on the milkweed itself, and so I can't think of anything that would be on the plant proper that you would destroy. It's quite common for caterpillars to leave the host plant and spin or pupate away from it and go through the transformation. So,
Wendy in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, we have a little old farmhouse in Richland County, and we've renovated it. It's probably 100 years old, but we've renovated it and replaced the windows. It's not sealed very well. But what happens in the fall and all through the winter is we get those little, I think they're called Asian beetles.
Mm-hmm.
They look like ladybugs, but
yep.
They act creepy. And what happens is we come in, turn the heat up from 50 to 70 or something, and the house heats up, and they dive bomb us all over the place. My questions are, how can we prevent them from coming in? And once they do come in, can we put some kind of liquid solution out that will drown them or kill them? They drive us crazy.
Okay. The first thing, perfect time for a call. In fact, it was interesting because with the cold that we had, typically I start to see this migration indoors after the first frost and then a nice Indian summer day. Although I was talking to somebody this morning on the phone that experienced Asian lady beetles going crazy about 4 or 5 days ago, which was quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to draw the line in the sand, and you do not let them get in. And that's either done by tightening things up, which probably is not going to be a reasonable choice in an old farmhouse,
mm-hmm.
or you spray the outside of the structure now, before they start
right
coming
now.
In. I usually tell people the last week of September, first week of October is the window that you want to treat. They're using various fly sprays, Tempo and permethrin and cyfluthrin and lambda cyhalothrin. These are things that you can get at often discount stores or Farm and Fleet or, you know, other things. And they're pyrethroid insecticides is what they are. And you spray it, especially the south side, because that's often the place that draws them the most, but also possibly the west and east sides. And the sprays both repel them, but if they land on the surface, it kills them. My problem is if they move underneath the siding and get in the wall voids, then I've lost them. You know, mm-hmm. the bombs in the house and whatnot don't do anything.
No.
It's, as they said, it's really a case that now's the time to prevent them from migrating in, and the dividends will be all winter long, whereas once they get in, you pay for it all winter long.
Right. Do you think a fly catcher with fly paper would work?
Oh, it catches them, but if there's so many critters there, it's just going to cover it up. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks, Wendy, for calling. Here's an interesting comment from Stephen Appleton, who says, I'm currently being treated for a chronic wound using maggot therapy. I've seen some benefits from the process, but don't understand the mechanisms by which the fly larvae work their magic, in quotes. Can you elaborate?
Well, this is an old technology. They used to use it even during the Civil War, and they found that when people had wounds that became infested with maggots, that certain maggots would only feed on dead, decaying tissue. And literally, their process of getting rid of this bad tissue would allow the wound to heal quicker. And so the therapy has been kind of reinvented, and they grow these flies under sterile conditions because you don't want them to introduce any bacteria. And they use them in burns and in some kinds of ulcerations and the like. And again, that's exactly the phenomenon. The maggots go in, they feed on the bad tissue, they pull it out, which allows the healthy tissue to come in quicker. And I do know that there's a gentleman up in that area of the state that raises these flies, and I think he makes them available to other physicians for use. So it's a, quote, an old technology, but they can do some things that we can't do ourselves. And as I said, it does seem to cause less scarring, quicker healing, so it is an advantage. On the other hand, of course, you know, as a society, we're not real keen about bugs crawling on us, and so it takes a little bit of tolerance on the patient's part, but it is a neat therapy.
Let's go to Harvey in Badger, Minnesota. Harvey, hello.
Hi. I got a problem in my lawn or whatever. It's like when you walk through it after you mow it, there's like piles of mud or whatever. You know, like they're digging up the dirt, whatever it is, like some kind of grub or worm or whatever it is.
I would think they're worm castings. You know, what you find sometimes is big night crawlers and the like will create almost like a little donut-like casting. Yep. It's usually a little granular looking. I see these quite commonly around maple trees. Worms just absolutely love maple trees. And so if you go out on a somewhat warm, damp night, you'll see the night crawlers on the surface literally pulling down the leaves into their burrows. You know, one of the arguments is that it helps aerate the soil. The castings, honestly, are good nutritionally for the lawn. The only problem is we do see occasions where things get bumpy enough and whatnot, that's a concern for people. And those can be raked out. You can go in over with a roller and the like. But, you know, ultimately, good things are happening. But as I said, if I had to guess, it's nightcrawler worm castings that you're finding.
Okay, well, how do you get rid of them?
Well, to be honest, there are no chemicals that are officially registered for killing worms. Some people have played around with detergents. You know, they'll wet the lawn, and then they'll put the detergent on there with the idea when the worms come up, it robs the slime layer on the outside and the worms drowned. But it's not an easy thing to do. And again, ultimately, when you talk about if you don't have worms in the environment, you get soil compaction and other problems. So really, the worms are a good rather than a bad thing. Now, in golf courses where they have trouble, my colleague Chris Williamson has worked with some very fine sand-like substance they put on the greens, and when the worms come up, it literally tears their bodies apart. This is, and I don't have the dimensions here. It is a ground, you know, when they remove the debris in a coal plant. I can't remember what that substance is called. It's like glass.
Not the ash.
But this is what they grind to a certain refinement size, and they can sprinkle it on the stuff. The trouble is chasing the stuff down is not going to be easy to do, but that's a physical way of trying to get earthworms. The other side is maybe you could rent a couple robins. you will see that kind of ebb and flow. But as I said, I mean, ultimately, I really don't think it's a good direction to go to kill all the earthworms because it's going to cause problems. Instead, as I said, consider maybe raking and whatnot, these castings, so that they don't cause the bumps. It kind of spreads it out, and ultimately, you will get a benefit in your lawn.
All right. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Carrie in Green Bay, on to you now. Hi, Carrie.
Hello there. You guys have an image in my head now. I'm sitting here eating spaghetti for my lunch, and you were just talking about maggots. So,
oh, boy.
Anyway, I was calling because earlier in the hour, you guys were talking about using heat to kill off bugs, and specifically bed bugs. And I've had the misfortune of living in an apartment building with them, and I found a couple of good ways of using heat to get rid of them that are cheap and with materials you've already got. I found the best tool I have ever had for killing any kind of bug is my fabric steamer.
Mm-hmm.
It cost me about $30 at Sears. It boils water, and I've successfully used it on glass, wood, drywall, every fabric under the sun, obviously. And I found, instead of trying to track down an expert, this particular apartment was sprayed about a half a dozen times with absolutely no results. Instead of trying to track down experts and special tools, I would say to anybody who's got a problem like this, try your fabric steamer first and see what happens. The trick there is trying to find where the bugs are coming from, which in our case, they were from inside the walls. But, after half a dozen visits from the pesticide spraying guy and getting nothing, this was by far the best $30 I ever spent.
Yeah, it definitely, we've had major pesticide resistance problems with bed bugs. That's the reason they've gotten to be such a stinker. Some companies do use steam machines, and they work great for mattresses and other things. Where the concern has always been is if they are deep in the wall, the steam doesn't penetrate as well as we would like it to. But definitely for anything on the surface. And it's not bed bugs' nature to go deep in the walls. I mean, they want to be on the mattress, in the box spring, in the headboards, and that tends to be where they'll concentrate, which means they're out in the open. What it does take is to be persistent and diligent enough to go through. I would even suggest it's worth going down right where the carpeting meets your baseboards to steam into those areas, because those kinds of cracks and crevices are also a hiding place.
Right. And in our case, we ended up having to take all the wood down off the walls, the baseboards, the crown molding, the wood that went around the windows. And we did have an odd case with them coming in from the walls. We also had the carpet steamed and all that, too. So
now, the one question I would ask in your case, if you were to call me in the lab, is would to see the bed bug, because that almost sounds like it could be the species associated with bats rather than human bed bugs. There is a species we see with bats. It will bite people, but it won't breed off of human blood. And it's quite subtle. The differences have to do with how long the bristle hairs are on the body. But traditionally, true human bed bugs, as I say, concentrate on the bedding itself. When I start seeing them in other places, falling through light fixtures and the like, it could be the bat bug. And there is even another one associated with chimney swifts. Had a couple cases this year where people were finding bed bugs in the bathroom. Well, that's real bizarre. And it turned out when I saw the species, it was the species associated with birds. We got to talking, and sure enough, they had chimney swifts nesting in the attic. And in the approaches, one of the nice things about these ones associated with the birds and the bats, they're much easier to kill. But you treat a totally different area. You're up in the attic doing your treatment. You're not treating the bedroom. And so that's the problem. If somebody misidentifies this, they're spending all their time and effort in the wrong place.
Ah, interesting. Right. Thanks, Carrie.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Dave emailed us and says, this past July I found a flying insect about 4 to 5 inches long, long slate gray mottled wings, and its front and back legs stretched so they were in line with the body. Appeared to be crane fly-like, only on steroids. Any ideas?
Oh, there are some big crane flies.
Oh.
You know, the giveaway, first of all, is any true fly has one pair of wings. So if this thing had one pair of wings, you know, the other things that are starting to big, that big Dobson flies, because the big jaw-like structures they have, yeah. they have other things that would have caught your attention. So, as I said, if it looked like a big crane fly, it is a big, diverse group. And we do have some very large species. You know, they look like giant, giant, giant mosquitoes. That's probably the best way to explain them to somebody.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network. Talking insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Happy to have you listening in. Lots of callers online, so we go right to the phones. And Terry in Milton, your turn. Hi, Terry.
Good afternoon, Larry and Phil. I'll get you started here with another wasp problem.
Okay.
I have a hot tub that's on my deck, and matter of fact, I'm looking out at it right now, and they're just swarming around there, and they're entering through the access panel, but they're underneath, and I thought they were a paper wasp, but aren't paper wasps, don't they usually nest hang down? Now, this nest here is more horizontal along the whole upper roof of the hot tub.
They can be variable. And again, depending, some species have certain traits or characters, but it's definitely in the realm of things. And again, I had mentioned that European yellowjack or hornet that's moved in. The Polistes is nests in weird places, and so that would be a potential. It could be that.
Now, is there any way, I mean, because it's a heated environment, I don't know if I'm going to be able to wait 2 or 3 weeks. Will they still be around?
It really depends on what the weather does. You know, if it stays cold and cloudy and whatnot, that will tend to cause the colonies to collapse quicker just because there's nothing to eat. They can't get out to do it. But it's a little hard to say. Now, the other side that you find with all these wasps, it seems, is as food becomes scarcer, they honestly tend to, you know, it's not best to think of them this way, but their disposition gets shorter. I mean, they tend to be a little bit more agitated. So you do have to be a little careful. So, you know, it may be something that you want to treat, or again, this may be a case that the shop vac, you know, idea that people are using might have a potential.
Okay, now, what about if I could, I see where they're getting in. Now, if I could seal the door up, would that...
Yeah, I don't like the idea of sealing it until I'm sure they're dead, because all it does is force them out in other places that are probably less. You know, the advantage if they're going into one spot is that's a treatable spot. And again, for this case, I would use a dust rather than aerosol if you can't see where the nest is. You know, if it's one of these things you could open the door and see the nest, I'm not so sure I'd take that risk. As I said, if I've got a spot where they're coming and going from, I would wait until about 7 o'clock at night and put some of this garden dust down so they have to get through it. And then by the next morning, things should be taken care of.
Well, I looked at it. I went out early in, this morning, and I opened the door very slowly, and it's a huge nest. And but right now, they're just swarming in there, and I just don't.
Yeah, you can't. During the day, you know, it's got a couple problems. You know, when you treat, there are workers that are out doing their thing, and they come back, they'll probably refuse to get in, and they get somewhat agitated. So timing is critical. And I find in the mornings, the problem is you can't get up early enough, because by the time there's enough light to work with, they're already active going in most cases. Now, the one possibility would have been this morning when it's, you know, 35 degrees or the like. You know, insects are not active at those kind of temperatures, so that does give you another potential time. But I tend to have had the best luck of going out, you know, half an hour before sunset, so I've got some light to work with. But things, you know, and the cooler the better if that's a possibility. But then just spot treating it, you know, taking a 5 to 10 seconds to treat something and then get out of there and let the dust do its job.
Okay.
All right.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thanks, Terry. Jenny and Nina, on to you. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. My question is about systemic insecticides. If that's used, say, for roses, will that transfer to the hips?
Potentially.
And I'm talking about the kind that you put in the ground, not, you know.
Right, right. Probably in small amounts, yes. One of the interesting things about systemics, it is a blessing and a curse, to be honest, is that they generally don't move near as well into reproductive tissue. That's why when people treat their roses for Japanese beetle, they can keep the leaves on the plant, but the Japanese beetles still eat the flowers. So it's relative. It's a concentration thing. But if you were to ask me, is there residues in the hips if you've been using systemics, I would say yes, there are. Low levels, but there are definitely residues in the hips.
Okay, so then I can assume then that if I were to use it or you were to use it for, say, chokeberry, you know, that gets a little sawfly larva on them.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to use that, then it gets into that fruit. What would that do for birds that will eat the fruit?
Again, the levels of concentration are low enough that I wouldn't expect an initial toxicity, and the chemical that's used there is not something that accumulates in the system like some of the older chemicals do. So I don't think it would really have much of an effect. It's interesting that talking to one of the distributors of one of the companies, they're going to come out with a systemic chemical for fruit trees. What they're doing is they're lowering the dosage, though. And my question in the back of my mind is, if they're lowering the dosage so much that they're not getting significant residues in the fruit, then I wonder if they're lowering the dosage enough that it's not going to do the job we want in certain things. And so this is going to be an interesting one to watch. And as I said, I really question that the performance is going to be quite a bit compromised by going with that lighter dosage. And so it's convenient, but if it doesn't work, it's not going to get you where you want to go.
Right. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Francis says, I've removed several nests using the shop vac method. I have an aluminum tube about 2 inches in diameter, which I lean up against the nest opening. I leave the shop vac on for several hours. The bees or wasps trying to enter are sucked up, and the ones that are trying to leave the nest are sucked in. And I place a 1 inch of soapy water in the bottom of the shop vac. And it works very efficiently.
Yeah, if you can get things set up, it sounds like you had to do a little modification. But, the behavior of the yellow jackets is such that even though they know something's fishy going on here, they have this strong drive to go into the nest, and that's what does them in.
Neil in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Neil.
Hi there. I have a cottage down in Walworth County that has chiggers. And funny, because none of the cottages a couple hundred yards away in the woods have any issues with this, but we've been going out there for, I don't know, 6-8 years now, and some summers it's worse than others, but unless I use one of those granular treatments of the entire area, kind of between the cabin and the fire pit and the deck and the places we walk, we have to wear DEET on our legs. And I've done a little research online and found that one way to treat them is with this granular, these granular poisons or whatever, but that seems to kill everything. And, if you're going out to commune with nature, you don't necessarily want to kill everything, all the ground slugs and everything else that's out there. And there was also a suggestion through one of these extension things online that if I put cards out on the ground with black paint on them, I could see the chiggers coming to the top and kind of congregating there waiting to jump on something. And I tried that this summer with 30 or 40 of these cards in various places, but didn't have any luck. They did say, though, that they kind of congregate in nests, and I was wondering if you have any other strategies to kind of find a nest and really treat it to get rid of it. I mean, the other thing they said is get rid of all the brush and underbrush and sort of clear it all out, and that really isn't feasible in this situation because it's in the woods.
A couple thoughts. I mean, to be honest, I wonder, maybe it wouldn't get as long-term results, but a soapy water spray, things like those small little mites are very susceptible to those kind of things on contact. So I think there are some things you might be able to use that have less broad-spectrum activity. As far as if I were getting an environment there were lots of chiggers, I think I would use the permethrin clothing sprays instead of the DEET, because that will kill them before they get much of an opportunity. DEET just kind of moves things around. We don't have a lot of chigger problems here, but if you get the right environment, you can run into them. I don't know if I would refer to them as nests. I find in raspberry brambles and whatnot, if I want to go looking for chiggers, those are the kind of environments I look for. And what chiggers really are parasites of insects. And we're a non-host per se, but that doesn't stop them from burrowing in and causing that incredible itching sensation. So, as I said, I think you might be able to manipulate with the soaps and stuff, if you know the areas, and just try to knock it down that way. But it would really be interesting if you ever caught something, because in the back of my mind, I asked the question, do you have bird mites or other mite species involved rather than traditional chiggers? You know, I talk to people who go out in the raspberry patch and they get exposed to it all the time, but I'm not that used to running into wooded situations where people have repeated problems. You might have a bad, you know, weekend where people get a lot of exposure, but this reoccurring thing is something that isn't as typical here as it would be in some of the states south of us.
Hmm.
Okay. Now, they look like little red mites, you know, and there are other mites that are out there that are red, so that's why they're using that black as a contrast. Is there any...
Are they visible to the naked eye?
Yes. Against a good background, they're definitely visible. They're small, but you definitely can see something's there. And, of course, the other problem on the reaction to chiggers is that there's this delayed reaction, so oftentimes your body's not responding for a number of hours. And so sometimes people have a hard time of correlating really where they were when they got the exposure, but it's definitely an outside critter. You don't run into chiggers indoors. So.
Okay. All right, there you have it. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Carol in Windsor wonders, what's your favorite insect and why? And if there's an insect you don't like, what is it and why?
Wow. Well, we got 18,000 in the state. I mean, as a general rule, I'm a beetle guy, you know, and just because beetles are so fascinating, and there's just, you know, scarab beetles is a real neat family, big tropical ones. And even some of the ones in Wisconsin are pretty diverse and pretty ornate. Dislike, you know, I'm fascinated by mosquitoes, but like everybody else, boy, they can sure kind of ruin the enjoyment of the outdoors. So if I had to pick on something, although bed bugs are getting close to that.
I was going to say, yeah. But what about bed bugs?
And it isn't so much. I'm one of those people, which many of us are like, we don't react to bed bugs, and I've never been exposed to very high populations. What I find so frustrating as a person who recommends treatment is it is not an easy thing to take care of anymore. And I don't see that changing in the short run. And so that one, I can very much relate to people who have just had a very difficult time and a lot of stress in their life because of this. They're expensive to treat. You need to know what you're doing. And as I said, so they're getting on my list might be a way of putting it.
Okay. Tony in Boulder Junction, your turn. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I've got, crevice flies. I have a home that has vertical siding, so there are many, many seams. Would be difficult to caulk at all. What do I do to get rid of the crevice flies that appear every year at this time?
Yeah. We call them cluster flies. And the thing about treatments is I'm a little nervous that you're a smidgen late, because normally I tell people the first week or so of September is the time to treat the outside of the structure. It's the same spray we use for the Asian lady beetles, the permethrins and the cyfleuthrins and the like. And you can have that commercially applied or apply it to yourself. And, you know, if they haven't started congregating yet, you're okay. If they've already worked up underneath the siding, that's where I'm concerned that it might be a little late. And what these are earthworm parasites in a natural setting. But in the fall, they look for shelter, and that's what drives them in. And so typically you can see them in a nice cool morning. They're literally stationary on the side of the house. And as soon as the sun hits them, they start to warm up. They start to crawl upwards. And that's when they're starting to sneak in to any kind of opening and overhangs and venting systems. And then, of course, you pay for them all winter long. And that's why they're sometimes referred to winter flies. And if people haven't seen them, they look very similar to housefly. Under a microscope, though, the thing that's very distinctive is they have this very fine yellowish hair. It reminds me of corn silk.
Oh.
You know, and that's on the bristles of their body and their chest, whereas house flies just have bristles and no fine hair. And so that's kind of a quick and easy way of telling them apart. And they do reoccur. Houses that are more exposed get more problems. The same house, exact structure in the middle of the woods where it doesn't get any sun on it, they have no problem with these flies.
No problem.
It's those sunny areas that draw them in to begin with, and then that's when they work up underneath. So spraying the outside now, and next year I would do it probably a couple weeks earlier than this.
Good luck. Thanks, Tony, for calling. And Joe in Minneapolis, it's your turn. Hi, Joe.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My call is... again, about these cluster flies. I heard your comments last year, Phil, and so this year I want to keep them out of my cabin, and I'm wondering, where do I purchase pyrethrum?
Well, straight pyrethrum, the problem is it doesn't have a residual. You want a synthetic pyrethrum. You know, Farm and Fleet sells a product called Tempo. which is an example of those products. But if you go to the local hardware store, what will amaze you is most of the products that are registered for spraying on structures have permethrin, cyfluthrin, lambda cy halothrin. These are the dominant insecticides that we have now. Now, the slight difference between what the pest control people will tend to use and what you use isn't the chemical, it's how it's formulated. What you find at most of the garden stores are straight liquid-based, whereas what people will often use are soluble concentrates, microencapsulated products. They tend to last a little longer. Do you really need those? Probably not. But if you were going for the top of the line, that would be things like Demand CS is a product that you can get, in Temporal. Ultra is a product that you can get. So they're more readily available than people think. But, you know, again, if you got any concern, local co-ops, you know, farm stores, because these are the same sprays that are used out in the dairy barns for killing flies.
All right. There you have it. Leo in Green Bay, hello to you.
Hi, thanks for the program. My question is about earwigs. We have them all over the house, in the yard, in the garden, upstairs, on my desk. Would like to know how to get rid of them permanently.
Permanently? My solution is you make your backyard a sandbox.
Yeah.
If you don't have any vegetation around the house, you will not have earwigs. They don't breed indoors. They come indoors by accident, but they will hang around for a while. But they are basically vegetation feeders. They like things lush and damp. And so that's why I said the environment of a very dry, sandy area is not where they would be. But if you've got landscape and you keep it watered and flowers, and then you mulch it on top of it, that's how I would grow earwigs. So then the second strategy is realizing that they start to come out of the ground as half-grown earwigs about the Memorial Day. And if you're going to treat, I don't treat indoors at all. That's, you know, you've already lost the war. You treat in the flower beds and the mulched areas where the earwigs are hiding. And the most efficient way is usually with these hose end attachments. So you're drenching, you're putting a lot of volume on, soaking it into the ground where the earwigs are hiding and killing them before they get an opportunity to come indoors.
There you have it. Thanks a lot for calling. Sandy in Fountain City wonders about camel crickets. Their home is only 9 years old, but they still get into the house, tried to plug any spots that I think they could get into. Last year was worse, quite a few in the basement walls and coming upstairs. I thought they only liked dark basements.
Well, camel crickets by nature, they're interesting because they're predators. They eat other insects for a living, and you tend to find them in damp, rocky areas. So if you go in the southwest part of the state and some of those rocky ridges is where I would find them, and you get a similar environment in the basement. So she's going the right direction in the sense that they're migrating in, so you try to tighten things up as best you can. That would be the first defense. The second defense is to anything you do to keep the basement on the very dry side. That would be a hostile environment for them. And then if that just doesn't work, this would be something that we typically treat with what's called a barrier treatment. You treat the outside foundation. In this case, you probably don't have to do it until, I would think, end of June. And you basically put a barrier that they have to crawl through and die before they get a chance to get in. Once they get in, boy, they're really tough to get because they're running around the basement, hiding underneath things. You know, spraying the basement concrete is pretty much worthless. So sometimes we talk to people about using these sticky glue boards as a physical trap. So when they're hopping around, if they jump on it, at least you got them caught and they will die. But again, I think the line of defense, you're heading the right direction, but it's more on outside sealing up, treating, and not so much worrying about inside, other than to dry things out as best you can, because as I said, they don't like dry environments.
Gabrielle wonders if she can save a large bald-faced hornet's nest in a tree. It's really pretty. Can you safely preserve it?
Oh, easily. Nothing special has to be done. As soon as you're sure the wasps aren't active, you just go and cut it out before you get a windstorm that might tear it up, and then you just keep it away from water. And it will take a little bit of water, but you know, so people that bring it inside and, you know, hang it on the mantle, it would be just fine. And no problem. They really, to look at them, are very intricately put together and have very interesting designs because the substrates that they use are different. This year, as in many years, I get a lot of complaints of people that have weathering cedar fences or decking, that the bald-faced hornets will come in and they tear off that weathering surface. They chew it off because that's what they use to help make that paper wasp nest. But then it leaves a physical, you know, the old stuff is gray and weathered, the new stuff is more yellowish, and it makes it look kind of tacky. And really the only solution there is to seal this up or paint it in some form, and then they'll leave it alone.
And what about yellow jackets and bald-faced hornets as far as overwintering? How do they overwinter?
It's fertilized queens. They produce the males for the first time in the late summer. The new, what we would call virgin queens, then go out and mate with these males. They store the sperm from those males for next year. And that's a pretty typical trait of insects to have this capacity. So then those new queens have to find an overwintering site, and they tend to disperse. They go away from the nest, find some place to spend the winter, hopefully pretty peacefully, and then in the spring they kind of wake up. So the first wasps that you see in the spring are all fertilized queens.
And she has clusters of box elder buds of various sizes, from tiny to full size, under a hedge between her yard and the neighbors. What are they doing and how'd they get there?
Box elder bug's behavior in the fall, again, is to seek shelter. And they have to be in the adult stage. They cannot survive as immatures. So the ones that are still small are probably not going to make it. They will also overwinter in rock piles and wood piles. They're just looking for shelter. So it may just be that that's a shelter site they're trying to get into. And if that's the case, fine, let them be. They can be a bit of a nuisance when they do that in your house. Just like some of these other insects, they sneak under the siding. And then every day it warms up in the winter, you get a couple of them crawling around. They're purely a nuisance. They don't hurt anything, but they're a bother. But then, like all these fall invaders, if you're going to draw the line in the sand, you got to kill them before they get in. The one nice thing about box elder bugs is they do respond very well to soapy water sprays of one sort or another. Although one of my favorite stories here is, you know, and I tell this a lot when I'm out teaching, I said, you know, my favorite recipe used to be a half a cup of Tide laundry detergent to a gallon of water sprayed on them. And that came from a colleague down at Iowa State University. And we were doing the show one day here, and somebody called up and said, I tried Cheer and it didn't work. Soap chemistries differ. Yeah. And if you're really serious about using soap, you use the insecticidal soap that you get at the hardware store or at the garden store, because that's the right stuff all the time. And it's a contact kill. It is a soap you could wash your hands with. But for soft-bodied insects like box elder bugs, it kills them. The trouble is if more show up tomorrow, you got to spray again. I mean, the soap doesn't last. But if they're congregated in a group, you spray them with soapy water. All the ones you spray are dead.
And what about woodpeckers pecking at vinyl siding? A friend who lives more than a mile away also has had a woodpecker pecking at her aluminum siding. Could there be an insect under the siding?
For those two, no. I get a lot of complaints in cedar, where if you look at cedar siding, there's a little straw-like ridge inside, and I get bees that get up in there, leafcutter bees, in the woodpecker. So there you get a very distinct pattern. You can see these lines on the side. The woodpeckers are finding their food. I don't see woodpeckers going after cluster flies and these other things, and so I wonder if these are just woodpeckers making noise or maybe trying to go, you know, because that's another issue, trying to sort through. Vinyl and aluminum is not a substrate I would expect them to try to get through looking for insects.
Phil, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much, and you'll be back...
About a month,
and we'll do this all over again. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. Take a look at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. Phil has lots of great things on that website, and I hope you'll take a look at it. Tomorrow, we'll discuss Parkinson's disease with a couple of experts. That's at 11 o'clock, and then at 11:45, we'll take up National 4-H Week with some guests as well. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network.